Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The FT. This week, Libya, a week on from the fall of Gaddafi.
As far as Britain, France, the US are concerned, the major challenge is that in the next phase, the Transitional National Council and the rebels don't break up into a kind of bloody fight between their constituent parts.
Has the Eurozone got through its latest crisis?
What's going to happen? Well, if they do need to do more haircuts, for example, on Greek debt, I think it'll be very hard to avoid contagion in the sense that people will be more sceptical of buying Spanish debt or Italian debt and so on. The question is, what do they do about that?
And an Indian hunger striker forces Parliament to support his anti-corruption crusade.
It was led by this man, Anna Hazare, who's a social activist from Maharashtra, who had actually had an earlier hunger strike for anti-corruption measures in April. But suddenly his August protests caught the government and many people across the country off guard.
You're listening to World Weekly with me, Gideon Rachman. We start this week in Libya. A week after the fall of Tripoli, Colonel Gaddafi still has not been captured. But that hasn't stopped planning for the future of Libya. In fact, an international conference is taking place in Paris to discuss the new Libya. The FT's James Blitz is there. James, the major powers and some of the Libyan rebels are meeting in Paris to discuss the way forward. But if you could just summarise for us, what's the situation they're facing?
I think the first thing to say is that the conflict is not completely over because you've got this group of Gaddafi forces at Sirte, his hometown, and also at this place called Sabha. And they form the kind of salient, if you like, which still has to be broken up by the rebel forces. And so they're still waiting to see what happens on the ground. But I don't think there's any feeling in Western capitals that that's going to be a major counterattack. I think it's just a question of how long it's going to take to flush all that out. So that's the first thing. And then I think what they're doing in Paris at the conference and what they'll be doing in the weeks ahead is to start discussing the way ahead for Libya now that the National Transitional Council has taken over.
What are seen as the major challenges and the biggest points to try and thrash out?
Well, I think as far as Britain, France, the US are concerned, the major challenge is that in the next phase, the Transitional National Council and the rebels don't break up into a kind of bloody fight between their constituent parts. I mean, I think there is a strong view that while you've had a pretty overwhelming victory against Gaddafi, most of these forces that have come together are very much united by the fact that they hate Gaddafi, but there's a lot over time that will divide them. You've got the Eastern rebels in Benghazi, you've got the Berber group in the Jebel Nafusa, who did a lot of the key fighting, you've had the Misrata group, you've got Islamist extremists and so on, and there's the possibility that these are going to sort of fall apart over the next few months. And so I think what Western powers want is they want the Transitional National Council to really set out a very clear path towards elections over the next 8 to 10 months and democracy, so that there's something for all these groups to actually get their teeth into politically rather than falling out in a kind of bloody way.
And do they think that that's likely, that they'll be able to get elections going in a country like Libya within 8 months? Isn't there also some risk in rushing towards elections? It's always a trade-off, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. And I think there was certainly a lot of discussion when the Egyptian revolution took place and Mubarak fell that you didn't want Egypt, for example, to go too quickly to elections because you needed political groupings to sort of have time to develop themselves. And that may be a risk here. I must say that speaking to people behind the scenes in the UK, I'm struck by how pessimistic people are about things coming together on the ground. I think there's a strong sense, for example, in the British Ministry of Defence, that we really now need to get out of Libya because a lot of people are very sceptical about the idea that these groups are going to come together, that they're going to find common points. That may be military scepticism, but certainly, at the very least, people don't have much of an idea whether this is all going to work out politically.
James, thank you very much indeed. Let's move to Europe now and look at the state of the Eurozone as we come out of the summer break and attention turns once again to the fate of the Portuguese, the Greek, Italian and Spanish economies. Joining me in the studio is the FT's economics leader-writer Martin Sanbu. The European politicians are just coming back from their summer break. Are they coming back to a situation that is improved from the near panic we saw in July?
I think they're coming back to very full in trays. There's a little bit of a lull in the markets right now, I think, especially after the European Central Bank intervened to buy Italian and Spanish government bonds after those yields went up. But there are at least three things that are happening now in September that could have a big effect on market sentiment. One is the IMF review of the Greek bailout program, where things are looking very, very bad. The deficit in the first 7 months of the year was worse than the same period last year. So there's a big question of whether this program, can it really work, even after these changes in July? The second thing is that the IMF will be publishing soon its Global Financial Stability Review, where it seems, according to the Financial Times at least, that they will say that potential losses in European banks are much bigger than what the Eurozone leaders say. And then the third thing is that we're supposed to see European parliaments ratifying these agreements that were made by the heads of government in July, on July 21st. And the particularly important decision is, will they let the European Financial Stability Facility, this rescue fund, will they let it buy the bonds of countries like Italy and Spain? The ECB has been buying them until now, but we know that the ECB doesn't like doing this. They want to get out. They want government treasuries to stand behind this. And these decisions have to come through. And we've seen these problems with, you know, Finland being sceptical, Austria being sceptical.
And the German Parliament.
The German Parliament, of course. Also, there's a decision by the German Constitutional Court on whether all of this is legal under German law. So there's a lot of stuff happening now in September that could really set markets off in one direction or the other. And it'll be an exciting month, I think.
Because they got close to their ultimate nightmare, really, in July, which was that the contagion spreads to Italy and Spain, two very large economies. The game now appears to be to isolate Greece, to convince the markets that Greece is an isolated case, even if a bad one. Do you think that's going to work?
I think they've made it harder for themselves because at the outset, you remember, they said Greece cannot fall. You know, if Greece defaults, the euro is doomed and so on. I don't actually think that's true. I think Greece could default and that wouldn't be a threat to the euro as a currency. It would be terrible for Greece and you would have these contagion effects to other sovereign debt markets. But I think they set themselves up for not having much credibility later on. Because
keep drawing lines in the sand and then walking over them.
Exactly. And they say, you know, if we cross this line, that's the end of the world. And turns out not to. So people probably expect them to cross these lines. So what's going to happen? Well, if they do need to do more haircuts, for example, on Greek debt, I think it'll be very hard to avoid contagion in the sense that people will be more skeptical of buying Spanish debt or Italian debt and so on. The question is, what do they do about that? And it's not that they're without tools. There are things they can do.
Looking further ahead, and I guess one has to, even with all these pressures building up over the next month in the market, the issue that seems to be out there and the current golden bullet is meant to be Eurobonds. This idea that the entire European Union stands behind the bonds of particular nations and then that makes them more credible. How close are we to getting there?
I think you're right. That is becoming more and more the big question. Will they go for Eurobonds? And as I mentioned, there are things they can do to stop contagion, and I think that would be one of them. They're not close at all. It's something that's being mentioned by some of the weaker sovereigns, as you would expect, but it's not endorsed at all by the creditor nations. Maybe as an end point of a very long process. As you know, I've written that I think parts of the Eurozone could actually go ahead even without Germany. And one of the advantages of a Eurobond is that you would have a much bigger bond market. And as you see, if your bond market is big enough, look at the US or Japan, investors have little choice and they will actually buy it just because it's so big and deep and liquid. It's basically the only place you can place your money.
The Sanbu resolution to the euro crisis.
Too big to fail, as it were. But realistically, I don't see anyone going ahead with this without Germany, and I don't see Germany doing it anytime soon.
Okay, last question on the Germans. I mean, I know it's meant to be not a good thing to put things in terms of household economics and national economics are very different, but it sounds to me like the Germans are being asked, in effect, they're saying, the guy next door to you can't service the mortgage on his house, so we want you to underwrite his mortgage. I mean, why would anyone do that?
It's an interesting analogy. You know, we always talk about how foreclosures are bad, not just for the people who are foreclosed on, but the people next door, because their property value falls when you have the big for sale sign and an untended lawn next door. You know, that would be the argument. Look, your house value is going to fall if your neighbor is foreclosed on and is kicked out of his house. Why not give him a hand and you'll both be better off?
So the whole neighborhood would go to hell, essentially.
Exactly.
Martin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And to our final topic for today, a 12-day hunger strike in India by an anti-corruption campaigner, Anna Hazara, has ended when the Indian government agreed to discuss Mr. Hazara's proposed bill to tackle endemic corruption. Joining me on the line from Delhi is the FT's bureau chief, James Lamont. James, give us an idea to people who haven't been in India what the Anna Hazara phenomenon was all about and how much it commanded the country's attention.
Well, it's essentially in August, political crisis blew out of nowhere, where with public protests across the country calling for tougher anti-corruption legislation. It was led by this man, Anna Hazare, who's a social activist from Maharashtra, who had actually had an earlier hunger strike for anti-corruption measures in April. But certainly his August protests caught the government and many people across the country off guard. I mean, it really did capture the imagination of lots of young people and the middle classes who all rallied to his cause and demonstrated in some of the principal cities, Delhi, Bombay, Bangalore, but particularly Delhi, which is where the hunger strike was centered. And the government, I think, underestimated the popularity of this cause and the nerve that it touched with a large sector of the population.
So how serious a problem is corruption?
Well, corruption is very widespread. It's very much part of the system. There have been some very big corruption scandals over the past year in the telecom sector, in the organization of the Commonwealth Games, and in the military top brass, which has really put it on the national agenda. But I think a lot of the protesters, certainly the ones I met, were much more engaged about daily corruption in their own lives, which was about land transactions or getting a railway pass or a ration card, and that they felt they always had to pay more to state officials. I mean, they even talked about traffic infringements where they were stopped and asked for kind of spot fines, and they just felt that in their own lives they're always having to pay a little bit extra to get government services. And in an environment where there's high inflation and costs are going up, I think that they are sort of the squeezed middle. They're feeling that revenues are being extracted from them and they're frustrated and they want something to change.
And what would the bill that Hazara has now forced the Indian Parliament to at least consider, what would it do and what's the likelihood it'll be passed?
Well, the government's been looking at new legislation since the 1960s, so this is a sort of 40-year-plus journey. I mean, what he's done is ask for tougher legislation. It's called the Lokpal Bill, and he's wanted it toughened up, and he's particularly asked for three things. One is that the anti-corruption legislation applies to the lower rungs of the bureaucracy, and not just the top. And of course, the Indian bureaucracy is huge. So this means that the reach of an anti-corruption watchdog would be that much greater. He's asked for an anti-corruption ombudsman structure to be in all states, not just sitting in Delhi, in the center, in the capital. And finally, he's asked for a citizens' charter, where essentially citizens are allowed to spell out their grievances over corruption. But as importantly are these things is that he wants action, and his aides and advisers have been really putting quite a slow-moving government under pressure to pass this legislation and not keep it in committee forever, and actually pass it within the coming weeks, which is where I think the pressure point certainly lies, because I think the government was rather hoping to kind of mull over this and distill it and come up with rock-solid legislation, but of course that takes a long, long time. And he's said, look, we want anti-corruption legislation now. And that has also triggered a debate about the role of civil society in India and whether laws should be dictated by people who are not elected officials, like Anna Hazare. He's a social activist, he's not a politician, and essentially he's an extra-parliamentary force trying to push through and negotiate new legislation. And some of the parliamentarians say this is a threat to the Indian democracy, and that it should be parliamentarians and lawmakers who make the law and not activists.
Final question. Do you think this is the last we've heard of Mr. Sir Hazara, or is he going to be a permanent phenomenon on the Indian political scene now?
I certainly don't think it's the last we've heard of him. I mean, the government made him almost immediately a hero by locking him up. He was jailed when he started his hunger strike in August, so he's now become a national figure, having been someone who was a little more obscure. I mean, he will certainly keep banging the anti-corruption drum. He himself has said that his campaign, which he calls the Second Revolution, he idolizes Mahatma Gandhi and says he's following in the footsteps of Mahatma Gandhi. He says his revolution has only just begun. So I think he will probably keep pushing on anti-corruption and hold the government to its word. But he's also said that he's going to broaden his cause. He's already done that in a way by looking not just at corruption, but governance and politics and politicians in India, but now he's talking about electoral reform as well. So I think this anti-corruption movement could turn into a broader civil society action across many issues that Indians, 1.2 billion people, are unhappy about.
James, thank you very much indeed. And that's it for this week. My thanks to James Blitz in Paris, James Lamont in Delhi, and Martin Sanbu in the studio in London. World Weekly is produced by LJ Filitrani. Till next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.